be able to answer committee questions. So with that, we're going to take roll. We have Representative Drummond is here, Senator Gardner is here, Senator Huggins, Representative Keller is also chairing this, as well as Representative Tallarico and Representative Calder. Welcome. And I'm anticipating at least one or two more representatives and senators from what I hear. They're over at another conference, but should be here shortly. So with that, are we going to, we're going to invite the Department of Education up, and Commissioner, if you'd like to come forward, and you can bring whoever you want with you. And before you do that, Chair Keller, do you have a few opening words to kind of set the tone for where we're going to go with the meeting?
Thank you, Senator Dunley. To put some housekeeping, for those of us down there in Juneau, our mics are automatic. These are not automatic. You got to push the button, get the red light, and but only when you're talking, because if four of them are on at a time, I guess they'll go out. So so I'll try to keep track of and remind you if you don't have your mic on. If you don't have it on, of course, you won't be heard by those listening online. Also, please introduce yourself clearly each time you speak. Because the recorder is online audio, and it's a little harder to follow, and I'll try to keep up with that, too. So just some housekeeping. 75 years ago today, the tragedy, this Pearl Harbor Day, you want to point that out, infamous infamy, flags are all at half-mast, and remembering that. Senator Dunley, I do want to make a couple of comments. One is I'd like to call attention to one particular section of 156 before we get started, because I think it sets a great context for talking about ESSA and implementing ESSA, and that is Section 1. It is one that Section 1 of the bill is not one that was hotly debated in Juneau. The media didn't really get after it much, but I wanted to point out that it's one of those hated, unfunded mandates on the local school district. One, it's one of the things that you're expected to do something because of Section 1. I think it wasn't controversial because of the fact that the point of Section 1 is parental rights, constitutional rights. You know, it's based on the concept of solid family, solid communities, and just making sure that it's very clear that parents have the right in the driver's seat when it comes to educating their own children. That's why I wanted to bring this up first, because, you know, like I say, it wasn't something that HB 156 was known for, but it is a perfect, it is exactly what ESSA is all about. It's a new section of law. By the way, I'd like to claim that, hey, I wrote this section, but I didn't. If you ever want to get Mike or Senator Dunley here alone or me, we'll tell you the whole story, but he's the author and of Section 1, and thank you. It's really good, and I recommend looking over it. It's a new section of law, and actually it's the third law in the whole 1403 series. The first one is, hey, there are going to be public schools. Number two, this is our purpose. Number three, hey, it put parents in the driver's seat. You know, so it's well placed. It's right after the establishment of purpose laws. The law intentionally sets no penalties for the not complying ones, so you're safe there. But frankly, I'm a little worried that we, you know, that we ignore it. That's part of the reason why I'm taking a few minutes here, stomping. I welcome Representative Seaton. We want to make sure that the spirit of the thing is carried out. The worry is that it's too familiar, and that even though the section will be read with appreciation, and most of us went forgotten or ignored because of the hassle of the efforts of trying to comply with ESSA and other mandates to come down. So, anyway, I beat that one to death. But the as long as I got the mic, I won't do this all the way through the meeting, I promise. But there's another section, too, and I'd like to point out that didn't get a lot of attention. It's another element, and that's a deletion. There's a deletion in there of a mandate on DEED to implement or follow through with what the federal law is. two little deletions. Everybody was okay with it. It wasn't really that controversial. But it was really significant because if, in fact, parents and school districts and local control is an issue, then we can't, from the state legislative perspective, just say to the Department of Education, go ahead and implement anything the federal government says. So even though it's not a direct and a clear mandate or anything or decisive, it just, by deleting that, I'm hoping it builds in an incentive, you know, so that there's more engagement by the legislature who are elected by the people. The role of a legislator, we got to apply for a job every now and then, you know, so it gives a very real link to the parents that are out there. So I just want to point that out, that the deletion is in there, and the feds have a tendency to fund very targeted funding in the state of Alaska, and then the department is expected to go in there and, accomplish or implement is the word, what they said. And it just left the parents, essentially, it left the parents out of the loop. So those two sections are a perfect context for talking about ESSA and making a presentation on ESSA. ESSA, if I remember right, it was talked about, it's going to return local control. I don't think it did as much as what I would have liked, but I see in there, in your presentation, there's a lot of places where the secretary cannot just mandate stuff, and it puts, I think HB 156 with ESSA and the good faith of the state board and the department and the school boards, you know, I think that the end result will be very positive on behalf of the parents. So with that, I'll let you go ahead and get started. But before that, Reverend Randall, welcome. I was in the middle of my little expose, but if you want to come up and join us, Liz is not coming today, so feel free.
So, I'd like to recognize Senator Diesel's here also, and Representative Culver had a statement.
Just a question, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification, in the sectional analysis, it says Section 1 requires written permission from parents before activities or classes. Programs on human reproduction are provided to a child, and I'm looking at Section 1A3, and it says providing for parental notification. Did I miss something here? Where is the requires written permission?
Reverend Culver, if you would, you will save that for when we get back into 156, and it's, the fault is mine. We're going to start with a presentation here on ESSA, and then there also in part of the presentation is going to be on 156, and we can discuss aspects of it then. It's just that I was using the prerogative of the gavel here to mouth off before we got started. So, Michael, welcome. May you have many happy days in front of the education committees, and good to have you here.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Johnson, and I'm the Commissioner of Education and Early Development for the state of Alaska. Thank you for this opportunity. I look forward to being able to meet you all in person, and I really look forward to our work together leading the education system in Alaska.
Sorry, I'm not quite sure how we're going to accomplish this, but for the record, Susan Bacali, Education Policy Coordinator for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you. So I've asked Dr. McCauley, she's been a great help during this time of transition as I assume my responsibilities as commissioner. She worked with you on HB 156 last spring. The legislature also provided the funding for her to continue working at the department and the role of Education Policy Coordinator. And so she's been heavily involved in the ESSA work that's taken place to date, and so I've invited her to come and give you a presentation to get us started.
Okay. So let's just check first. Is that sufficient? Okay. And just tell me if it's not, because I skip over here. So what we're going to accomplish today is to provide you, as Senator Dunleavy said, with an update regarding ESSA. do everything to seize act on specifically Alaska's development of our state plan under Title I. We're going to also provide an update regarding implementation of House Bill 156 and obviously answer your questions here, any comments or concerns that you have. There are two distinct sections of the presentation. If it's possible to go through the ESSA section and then take questions collectively, I think that would be our preference, given that we've taken attention in preparing the presentation to answer some of your pre-submitted questions. And then so we could pause at the end of ESSA and take questions, and then go into House Bill 156 if that works for you, Chair Dunn. So we want to start, though, by making clear that while we're going to talk specifically about ESSA, we want to be really clear that ESSA is not intended to be, nor is it our desire that it be, our vision for public education in Alaska. The State Board of Education has been crystal clear about that in their leadership over the last several years. Commissioner Johnson has been consistently clear in his messaging with educators across the state that federal rules are not our vision for education in Alaska. Since Commissioner came on in July, he and the board have worked deliberately in clarifying a couple of things that are front-loaded in our conversations across the state. We don't begin by talking about ESSA. We begin by talking about these things. The vision statement for public education in Alaska is clearly established in Statute 1403.15, which states that the vision, the purpose, is what it says, for public school in Alaska is that all students can succeed in their education and work, shape worthwhile and satisfying lives for themselves, exemplify the best values of society, and be effective in improving the character and quality of the world about them. That's what our state law establishes as the purpose of education in Alaska. The mission statement has been newly adopted by the State Board of Education, something that we think can be helpful to our districts in the way they think about their responsibilities in accomplishing those outcomes as established in statute. Mission statement is an excellent education for every student every day. The board has recently revised its previous three strategic objectives for a strategic plan through a lot of discussion at their board meeting in September and continued discussion at their board meeting on Thursday and Friday of this week. They've established five strategic priorities. The first is to increase student achievement. The second is to inspire community ownership of educational excellence. The third is to modernize the education system. The fourth is to ensure excellent educators. And the fifth is to promote safety and well-being. The board is continuing work now in developing specific actionable goals for each of those strategic priorities. So when we talk about ESSA, we want to, again, be clear that it cannot be, what we develop as a state plan cannot be in conflict with those things. It can't be in competition with those things. It has to be complementary to them, or we've got the cart before the horse, I think, is a reference I've heard the legislature say over the years. We've got things in the wrong order. We want to be really clear that as we go into ESSA, we need to make it synchronous. What we do as a state needs to be synchronous with our state laws and with the leadership of the State Board of Education and the commissioner, and with the desire of the legislature. So I actually see a lot of the tenants in House Bill 156 synchronous with a lot of the intent of ESSA, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. But there's been a good reason that there was a lot of bipartisan support for ESSA, and that's because no one wanted another No Child Left Behind. And there are, as we'll talk about, real distinct provisions in ESSA that make that clear in a way that no federal law for education ever has before. Laws always say what you have to do. They infrequently say what you can't do. And ESSA is full of prohibitions that cannot occur in response to the bureaucratic one-size-fits-all and heavy-handed nature of No Child Left Behind. So let's dig into the substance here. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act was passed in 1965. The goal is specific to improving the quality of education for low-income students. The iteration of that went into place in 2002 is No Child Left Behind.
And while, again, ESEA was originally focused on low-income students, No Child Left Behind, for all intents and purposes, became a system of public schooling with prescribed metrics that were imposed on all schools in the country. Every student succeeds act, which really honestly came out of nowhere last December, our best advice from D.C. was that it was not happening. It was kind of dead in the water. And then it got major momentum and went through last December. It is really an attempt to return to states a lot of the decision-making ability that was removed by No Child Left Behind. We'll go into that in more detail here shortly. So there are three key provisions under Title I, three key elements, I should say. Standards and assessments, accountability, and school support and improvement. We're going to walk through each of those. But before we do that, I just want to talk about our approach, in addition to what I've already said. Our approach in going about developing our state plan is to lay a foundation to get the most benefit for Alaska students. We want to ensure that our state plan represents what Alaskans value. So we started through last March engaging stakeholders in conversation. Coming to the table at that point with kind of some blank sheets of paper and engaging them with some key questions and getting responses to hear what their sentiments were so that those could inform the development of our state plan. We have not begun, so to speak, to actually develop the specific components. Meaning, when we dig into some of the detail here, and the law talks about the requirements for our state accountability system, we've not made decisions about those requirements. We wanted the engagement of stakeholders to inform our plan, not to get out in front and start developing things in a perfunctory manner that assumed that we knew what stakeholders wanted. So for each element under Title I, I'm going to talk very briefly about what is the law say we need to do, how is it different from NCLB, and what is our current status? Not where we're going, but what's on the books currently in terms of what we have in place right now that exists in state law. So the key first element of standards and assessments and the requirement under Title I is that we need to provide assurance that we've adopted challenging academic content standards in English and math and science. We need to provide an assurance. We need to assure that those standards are aligned with college entrance requirements in our public system of post-secondary education and relevant CTE standards. The big difference here is what the U.S. Department of Education cannot do. They cannot exercise any authority over our standards. They can't require us to submit our standards to them for review. They can't incentivize the adoption of any particular set of standards. And all of this is in response to what was done by the U.S. Department of Education through the ESEA waiver that they made available to states to get out from under No Child Left Behind. They did those things. The law now, ESSER says they may not do that. So our current status is we adopted standards in ELA, English Language Arts and Math, in 2012. We adopted standards in science back in 2006. We will continue to consider the adoption and revision of standards with the State Board of Education. Processes for doing that are an ongoing discussion with the department, with the State Board, and we need to determine what those processes look like. But currently, that's where we stand in terms of what would be required by ESSA for assurance with regard to standards. With regard to assessments, also requires that we assess annually in ELA, English Language Arts, Math, and Science, that English Language Arts and Math needs to be annually in grades 3 through 8 and at least once in grades 9 through 12. And we have to assess in Science at least once in the grade bands of 3 through 5, 6 through 9, and 10 through 12. The difference in those requirements from No Child Left Behind is that ESSA allows us to use a single summative assessment, which is what we've been doing for a long time, or multiple interim assessments that produce a summative score. There's very little precedent of any state having done that, and the field of assessment is quickly adjusting to how to do that from a perspective of technical accuracy. It also says that districts could choose to use other nationally recognized high school assessments instead of the state's assessments if they want to, with the state's permission, is what it says. It allows states to establish their own laws regarding opt-outs, which is exactly what House Bill 156 addresses, that it is now recognized in state and national law that states may do that. There was a real question about that for a long time, and a lot of going back and forth between states and the U.S. Department of Education when states did that. Now it's very clear that states have every right to do that. It does say that we have to maintain a 95% participation rate, but it specifies that the consequences for not meeting this requirement are determined by states, not by the U.S. Department of Education. And they've given a short list of options for states. But the law is really not specific at all regarding what those consequences need to look like. So our current status is we've been administering an assessment in English and Math in grades 3 through 10 for a long time. We administer our science assessments in grades 4, 8, and 10. We could continue doing what historically we've been doing and be compliant with the new requirements under us. Let's go into the second section, and that's accountability. And so what the law says now is that the accountability system has to meaningfully differentiate. And what that means is that if we put in place an accountability system where, let's say that we maintain our current star rating system, and every school in the state of Alaska got 5 stars, that would not meaningfully differentiate. Or if every school got 1 star, that would not meaningfully differentiate. It says that we have to have an ambitious, state-designed, long-term goals for all students and for the traditional subgroups of students, economically disadvantaged, students with disabilities, Alaska Native students, so on. It says that we have to include 5 indicators. I'll show you what those are in a moment. It says we can include others if we want to. So we have to weigh the academic measures more heavily than others. Doesn't prescribe percent, it just says they need to be weighed more heavily. And that one way or another, we have to incorporate a required participation rate of 95%, meaning that has to be factored in some way in our metric. So these are the 5 required indicators under ESSA. We have to include academic achievement as measured by proficiency on state assessments. So that's the traditional, what percent of your kids are proficient on the assessment that we're familiar with. We have to have another measure of academic achievement. Most of the time, that's probably going to be growth. So how much did a student grow from year to year, whether or not they're proficient? If they were proficient, are they still growing? If they're not, are they at least moving in the right direction? And there has to be accountability for that. We have to include high school graduation rate. We have to include a measure of school quality or student success. And this is new. And it is really intentional, actually, because, checking my opinion versus fact here. So I'll start with arguably, the focus on academic achievement and No Child Left Behind indicated that that is all that mattered. And the metrics were so prescriptive and the consequences in some ways have expanded that some would argue that it resulted in things that weren't measured being perceived as not important. Social studies, art, music, school climate, school safety, parent participation or perception of their school. So this is specifically included in the new law to recognize that we know that effective systems of public schools, healthy schools, are about more than performance on once-a-year standardized assessments in reading, writing, and math. And so the law now actually requires states to settle on a measure, a non-academic measure of school quality and student success. So we'll have to figure out what we want to do with the state. It also now brings in that we have to somehow incorporate measure of progress in learning English for students identified as English learners. There really was not a great deal of accountability for that under No Child Left Behind, and that we now have to work in as our overall, as part of our overall school metric. So this is incredibly different than No Child Left Behind, actually. No Child Left Behind, as we all remember, had adequate yearly progress where you're moving from year to year with a metric that was designed to result in 100% of kids being proficient by 2013. That is entirely eliminated. There are no uniform metrics that are imposed on all schools in the country at this point. States have to design those metrics. And the law further, this isn't clear enough, prohibits the secretary from prescribing aspects of the accountability system. You know, the law says, for example, that the academic measures have to weigh more heavily, but it prohibits the secretary from saying how much. The secretary can't say they need to be 70%. They can't prescribe any other aspects of the accountability system other than those clearly already outlined in the law. So our current status is that we have in place the Alaska School Performance Index, which we've talked about over the last couple of sessions, and a final summative star rating of 1 to 5 stars. You remember we talked about those metrics where for elementary school academic achievement, which is proficiency, is 35% of the metric, school progress is 40%, meaning how much kids grow from year to year, and attendance rate is at 25%. We could maintain most of that if we wanted to. You know, the attendance rate, if we wanted to, would qualify as that new measure of school quality and student success. It's a non-academic measure. We could keep it or not. We've got school progress in there. We would need to work in progress of English learners into the elementary metric. But, you know, if we wanted to keep it, it's almost entirely compliant with the new requirements. Our high school works in graduation rate. So that's also required by ESSA, and had a college and career ready indicator in there initially, which we now know has been repealed in terms of those requirements. My point, though, is that much of our current metric is consistent with the requirements under ESSA if we choose to keep it. We need to figure out what we want to do. We have a star rating system. We could keep it or not keep it. The new law does not require this kind of overall summative rating. We can choose to do it as a state or not choose to do it as a state. So let's talk about the final section under Title I, and that's school support and improvement. So the requirements here under ESSA are that we have to identify schools that require support. We have to identify schools for what's called comprehensive support. And those schools are the lowest performing 5% of Title I schools and high schools with graduation rates less than 67%. The law says those schools have to be identified for comprehensive support. Interestingly, it is very vague on what comprehensive support is. It's not prescriptive in a way that can entirely different than No Child Left Behind about what that support looks like. No Child Left Behind is a kind of short list of, you know, switch out the principal, switch out 50% of the staff, move it to a charter school, none of those things, nothing like that is prescribed in ESSA. It just says comprehensive support and safe. Figure out what that looks like. It says that any school where there's a subgroup of students that is consistently underperforming has to be identified for targeted support. But it does not define consistently underperforming. So we have to determine as a state at what point is a school consistently underperforming in a subgroup and what's targeted support for them going to look like. It says that strategies must be evidence-based. And this is different than the previous language in federal law that said things had to be research-based. This is a response to a feeling that no child left behind really squelched innovation. That requirement for research-based was a technical requirement that unless there is research, which is a pretty high bar, saying that a support or an intervention is going to be effective, it's not going to meet the federal requirements. Evidence-based means that there needs to be some evidence that falls short of that research requirement, that whatever we do is going to work, but it's backing off because of a lot of sentiments by commissioners across the country that they were not able to engage in the innovative practices to really try to turn around low-performing schools because they wouldn't meet the federal requirements for research-based. So differences from NCLB, I've already gone into a little bit, no prescriptive improvement strategies or interventions, prohibits the secretary, again, from prescribing any, and that movement from research-based to evidence-based are the main differences here. So our current status with regard to this is that we've been identifying, as was required by our waiver, focus and priority schools. We've been monitoring their school improvement plans and their use of funds, as was required by our waiver, and we have been using a coaching model through the state system of support to support our lowest performing schools in the state. And all of that was put in place to comply with our requirements under NCLB and our NCLB waiver. So a lot of questions, obviously, about, okay, in light of the new administration, now what is going to happen? So we consulted with our kind of legal advisors in D.C. and posed that question to them. And just as a direct quote, they said, there's no appetite in Congress for revisiting ESSA, that it was bipartisan, that the folks who engaged in developing that law feel that there are both appropriate guardrails and flexibility, and they want to give implementation a chance. The U.S. Department of Education has put out regulations, though, and we've been watching those very, very closely. Those regulations, you know, have the possibility of either being consistent with the intent of ESSA or inconsistent with the intent of ESSA and overly prescriptive. So, again, we've been watching those closely all summer. The first draft set of regs came out in early summer. We submitted formal public comments to the U.S. Department of Education regarding their draft regulations and focused in on several key areas. The timeline for implementation, we, along with just about everybody else in the country, felt was not going to result in quality work. They wanted the accountability system developed during this school year and applied to all schools for the beginning of next school year using assessment data from this year. And we felt that that was not going to result in quality work. They also were going to move to require an overall summative rating for schools, like a star rating. The law doesn't require that. And it's not that we think that's a bad idea necessarily. We just don't think that the U.S. Department of Education should tell us to do that if the law doesn't require it. So we submitted public education to that effect as well, public comment to that effect as well. The law also is not prescriptive with regard to the use of a four-year graduation rate. And while this doesn't seem like a big deal, it actually is a big deal for schools that serve special populations. So So the law itself frequently refers to a four-year graduation rate or an extended year graduation rate, which is basically a five-year graduation rate. Our current metric permits the use of a five-year graduation rate for schools that serve special populations, like our alternative schools. The initial draft set of regulations did not have permitted that, and we submitted comments that said we didn't think that was right, because the law doesn't require it, and we felt that that would result in our alternative schools automatically qualifying as comprehensive support schools just because of the nature of the kids they choose to serve, who come in credit deficient, and for many of them, it's actually impossible when they come to their schools for them to graduate in 4 years. And they, our alternative schools have a really impressive data that shows their success with those students getting to graduation, just not in 4 years. So the final regulations just came out, or they're called final regulations, just came out last week. And the Department of Education revised the regs in all of those areas. They moved the timeline for implementation to the new accountability metric being utilized at the beginning of the 2018-19 school year. So we have using data from the 17-18 school year. They moved the whole thing a year, which, I mean, we feel is just really important if we're going to do a good job here. They removed the requirement for an overall summative rating. We can do that or not do that. And they are permitting the use of a five-year and extended year graduation rate for schools that serve special populations. But I want to back up with that for a moment. So the regs are called final regs. However, they are subject to reconsideration, of course they are, in light of the new administration. Because they have now been indicated as final regulation, and they will go into effect on January 30th, there it will be a bit more work for them to be undone, but the words of our folks in D.C. will say not that much. Meaning, you know, the regs are now final, the new administration, you know, through a new Secretary of Education can choose to reconsider those, to move to reconsider those if they wish. And so we will debate and see. They did, as I said, the U.S. Department of Ed did adjust the components of their initial regs that were most off-putting to folks around the country. So it may be that there isn't a lot of heartburn over those at this point. We'll have to see if they stick or don't stick. So I just wanted to give you an example of what are some key decision points that we need to figure out. And there is a lot of technicality to this Title I section for ESSA. We need to figure out, for example, if we want to test one grade in high school or more than one grade in high school. The law requires only one grade. We can choose to do that, or we can choose to test in more grades. We need to figure out something like N size for subgroup accountability, and that's, you know, we have to disaggregate data and be held accountable for all of those subgroups of students. We have to decide how many students create a subgroup. The final regs that came out last week say that you can't have a subgroup size of more than 30. But our current subgroup size for state law is 5. So do we want a subgroup size that small, or do we want to go back to what it originally was under No Child Left Behind, which was 25? We've got to figure that out. And in a state like Alaska, with so many small schools, that decision really creates a different picture of accountability based on where we set the subgroup. So we've got, you know, a lot of work to do and have already been gathering information from stakeholders regarding their sentiments about that. And we've got to figure out, as I said, what do we want to use as a state for our measure of school quality and student success. We could use attendance rate if we wanted to, or we could choose to do something entirely different. Our under school support and improvement, we need to figure out what supports are perceived by our districts, our communities, as most helpful. There is a lot of language in the law that says that those improvement efforts have to be designed with local input, which, again, is really consistent with language in House Bill 156. We've got to decide what innovative approaches can be taken that will be responsive to our unique opportunities and challenges. And, again, in a state like Alaska, it is a bit refreshing that the federal law permits us to make those decisions rather than impose improvement strategies that are likely not going to be effective in some of our rural communities, just given their unique nature. So our process for developing the state plan is that we're using work by our stakeholder groups to help prepare tribal organizations, school districts, parent groups, associations to assist with our state plan development. We have begun consultation, as I talked with you about last session, with broad representation of our stakeholders. We've been doing that consistently, and that has been a lot of the work that I've done in my position. We've done a lot of focus groups across the state at our traditional education conferences and when we've been invited to come. AFN, for example, is an example where we were invited to come and we went and did a session there. We are now moving toward forming topic-specific work groups. So we've got to figure out exactly what the makeup of those is going to be. But where we really dig in and to some of these highly technical issues and figure out what we're going to do to meet these requirements. We hope to have a draft plan by March, but we do not, the last bullet there, we do not intend to submit our plan until September. So initially, the submission windows and the initial regulations were March and July, and that changed last week, and they're now, I think it's still March, it might be May, but the second one, which we have our eye on, is September. And that's when we intend to submit, because we think that taking time, process-wise, to develop our plan, to let things settle out with the new administration in D.C., see where those regs end up, will serve us well in the development of our state plan. Do we intend to seek broad input to it? Some of that will be through face-to-face meetings. Certainly, when we have a draft plan, we will have that available for review and engage folks in providing comment to us. The State Board of Education needs to certainly be engaged in this, and they have to approve all of the related regulations. And those things take time. There's a public comment process with all of that, but we need to engage them, and we do at each board meeting. And as I'm not sure that I mentioned it, but the law requires consultation with the legislature. So we will need to determine what that looks like, both in terms of meeting the legal requirements, but probably more important, meeting the expectations in our state for what consultation with the legislature looks like. On our website, there's a star that is called ESSES, and we regularly update this with information, presentations, meeting sphere space where people can provide input to us. And we've been just making people aware of that on a regular basis so that they know that that, you know, can be a first stop in terms of what we're doing and they're providing input. So that is the ESSES section of the presentation, and we're happy to take any questions that you have.
Okay. If you would, when you ask questions, refer to the slide and kind of pull us back to the context of the presentation before you ask it. Before we proceed, I just wanted to point out that Commissioner Hanley's back there. I forgot to acknowledge him. So if anything goes wrong, we can blame him. He can handle it. And then Representative Keto, welcome if you want. There's an extra seat up here. And anyone feel free. Also, I believe Representative Hughes is online. And I think that's something. Superintendent Hammer would appreciate this as Commissioner Johnson does. Commissioner
Cameron was commissioner, and he's now 66% of the Chief Apps School District. And Mike Johnson's current commissioner. So,
thank you for that clarification.
Great. Any questions? Well, there was one Rainbow, and then Senator Gardner.
Chair, I would give you my quickly summarize, make sure I don't have any name of that wrong, and then I have three questions. So with that, basically what I've always said is that hamburgers are the standard. The hamburgers are like the standard. The buns are like the assessment, and as the state legislators, we're lucky if we get to pick the condiments that go on the hamburger at a great cost.
Rather than go through all three of your questions, just take one now, and then we'll come around Robin's here so we don't get tunnel vision on one aspect of it, and we'll come back to you. We'll get to all your questions, but just go ahead.
Okay, so basically, just to summarize, basically what I have heard you guys say is Common Core, the Common Core standards, then they were changed to Alaska Academic Standards, now they're College and Career Academic Standards, and according to the letters that you sent back and forth to the federal government, they're virtually identical. The federal government is requiring a 95% mandate on the assessment to the Common Core or the Alaska Academic Standards. Then there's a law, according to ESSA, that these also have to meet the college requirement test, so such as possibly the ASAT and SAT that are now Common Core aligned, as you well know. They have to meet the college interest according to slide number 10. And so I want to know any specifics in regards to the and it says the college entrance requirements for the public system. Can you elaborate? That would be my very first question in regards to that. What specific tests are there specific tests?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the law says that our standards need to be aligned with college entrance requirements, not any specific assessment.
Okay.
The way that was accomplished for Alaska was a review by our university of the standards and whether, if students met them, students would be ready for college-bearing classes as freshmen in our university system. There is no requirement for a score on any particular assessment, and that review was not linked to any particular assessment. It was, again, it was a review of our standards and a determination by the university that if students in our public school system met those standards, they would be ready to be successful at college. It's not linked to an assessment.
Staying on that same question.
Okay, well, I just want to reference this. We're talking about the standards and assessment part of your presentation. I think this is roughly on slide 12. So that's
Well, I was just in regards to the aligned with college entrance requirements. Can you just elaborate? Is that referring to the University of Alaska? And if so, can you elaborate on that?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, it's exclusively referring to a determination that if students go through and graduate from a public school in Alaska and meet the standards at each grade level, will they or will they not be prepared to be successful at college? There's no prescription, and there certainly is not in ESSA, that be determined in any particular way. With our current standards, there was a review of them by the University of Alaska and a determination, as indicated to the department in a letter from the university president, that if students met those standards, they would be ready for credit-bearing courses as freshmen. The intent in the new law is that there not be gaps between the K-12 system and the post-secondary system. The systems of public education are supposed to be working in concert to ensure that when students go through them, they're prepared. When students go through the K-12 system, they're prepared for what comes next. That's the intent of the law, but there is no prescription in the law for how we accomplish that. we simply need to provide assurance to the U.S. Department of Education to meet up the requirements that our standards are aligned with college entrance requirements, and they don't prescribe how we do that.
Well, I'm not questioning it. You made a comment in the presentation that these things would be about the program on our standards. As I understand it right now, we have established standards. They're there. That's your opinion. But what is the process of is there a set cycle that goes through as far as the degree? Is there anything like that where you're just doing the noise gets loud enough that we have to do it or depends on it?
Representative Keller, there is not a set process in regulation. There is a requirement in statute that the Department of Education establish standards. And certainly, obviously, there's a federal expectation there as well. But the process for doing that is not prescribed in regulation currently. And that is what our slide is intended to get at, is that you need to consider the processes by which we're going to do that. When we're going to do that, how we're going to do that, should that be prescribed or guaranteed on some sort of regular basis, or should it be more, qualitative when for some reason it seems that we should? It is not. Those processes are not currently established in statute or regulation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following up on Representative Reingold's question on the standards and the university looking at those, of course, the University of Alaska has open enrollment, and so was the criteria they looked at that they would be ready for courses without any remedial courses? Is that, we have a large percentage of students that come out of our school system that require remedial courses. So was that the qualification that they were saying?
Through the chair, Representative, it was. It was a review to determine, and I'm just recalling now the specifics of that, so I don't have them here in front of me. There was a committee of representatives from each of the three campuses came together to review them, and the determination that our current set of standards are aligned with post-secondary expectations was, if students meet them, will they be ready for credit-bearing, non-remedial courses
that
I rolled up to the system.
So,
yeah, that was their standard.
Thank you,
Ms. Chung.
Got a follow-up on it?
Following up on Representative Seaton's question, maybe more of a statement. It doesn't make any sense to me. Meaning, not what you're saying, Doctor, but yes, you have people that transfer in from all over the country to the university system that don't even go through our K-12 system. And then they may have adopted different standards, especially in ESSA in Florida, and they've come up here and they transfer and they're going into our schools. And we have a high, large military population that takes courses as well, and it's very transient. But you're using words that I'm trying to understand. No gaps between the K-12 and the college system. How's that possible? Again, it's not you, but it's just, how is that possible? It's not a unified system, never was never intended to be a unified system. The college system is totally different. And is there an expectation that if we adopt certain standards at the K-12 level, that by the time they get ready for college, that they should do fine, and if not, what happens? Or whose fault is it, or what is the responsibility? And again, I probably will never live to see the day where we differentiate between remedial and developmental, but because they are very different concepts. What are they really trying to accomplish? Are they really trying to accomplish and have K-12 schools as just actual feeder schools to universities? Or I'm not really sure what they're trying to accomplish, so I'll just leave it at that. or a comment before I...
Senator Dunleavy, I think what they're trying to accomplish is, I don't think that they're trying to accomplish K-12 schools as a feeder system to the university. I think they're trying to accomplish that when students choose to go to the university, that they are adequately prepared to be successful there, and that there will not be high rates of students who graduate from high school and are unprepared to take credit-bearing freshman classes. That's what I think they're trying to accomplish. Interestingly, and this is different from their child left behind, but interestingly, the new law also says that they need that the K-12 academic standards need to be in line with relevant CTE standards. That's new. And to me, that speaks to that there is not a perspective that K-12 schools are exclusively supposed to be feeders to university. They are also supposed to be effectively preparing students to enter the workplace or some other level of post-secondary training, whether that's a certification, when students choose that route rather than a traditional four-year college program.
Thank you. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you asked my first question already, which was about how often standards are reviewed and updated. And I have another just really quick one, and that refers to page 30 when you're talking about the work with stakeholder groups. And I just am curious to know if Great Alaska Schools was invited or participated in working on a state plan.
Through the Chair, Senator Gardner, I would need to revisit our... my answer to your question is that I don't know conclusively. I need to revisit the methods by which we constructed our first, go with this, our advisory committee, and who those members are. So I can't answer that conclusively, not having that. Okay. Thank you.
So, Gunn, maybe?
Thank you. Please, please, consultation with legislation. So, ESEA came in 65.
The ESEA came in 1965 on the heels of the Civil Rights Movement, and the idea at that time, I think, was to bypass the state legislatures because they were viewed by the federal government as being an hindrance to the Civil Rights Movement. And that attitude, I think, took hold and continued, I guess, up until this moment. So, under ESSA, what does that consultation look like?
Chair Dunleavy, the law does not prescribe what it looks like.
Just says consultation.
It says consultation with the legislature. And that language is included in a paragraph that requires consultation with a whole lot of entities. Parents, administrators, teachers, the governor, state boards of education, the legislature is in that list of the groups or individuals with whom consultation has to occur. But it doesn't say at all what that needs to look like.
One last one for the moment. Yes, please. It seems like there's a lot of ambiguity in the new bill. Or some would call it flexibility. And I guess the only question I would have for the department in part of the consultation is, it's rhetorical. Will the department take a minimalist view of when there's ambiguity, will the department take a minimalist view, meaning if we don't want to do it, we don't do it, which gives maximal flexibility to state initiatives, or will the department take the view that it's a maximalist, and if they don't define it, then we'll have to define it, and meaning we'll have to, for example, it talks about subgroups. We have different subgroups. 5 to 30 is what I heard, and we have 25. So the question would be, why would we want to have any subgroups at all if we don't have to? Or why would we not want to minimize those subgroups, and why would we want to maximize those subgroups? So I guess the question is, when you're going through this, and you're talking with, you're having consultation with your board, to just think about the benefits, the pros and the cons of having a minimalist approach to the federal bill here, or a maximalist approach. Is that making sense to you at this point? Thank you. Good. Thank you.
I could respond to them. We started engaging stakeholders last March. That wasn't required. In my personal opinion, we've gone far beyond in terms of consultation in some cases than is required by the federal law. already. There's nothing that I have been hearing from our State Board of Education, from our commissioner, or nor from our legislature that a minimalist approach in terms of consultation is going to meet the expectations in the state of Alaska. And I think that focusing on meeting those expectations will be more than compliant with the vague expectations in the law itself.
I don't want to keep on this topic much longer, but Senator Huggins, go ahead. I have another question on 30 also.
Yes, so if I could very quickly, I just made a couple notes to myself on your slide number 4. And just like to highlight that, in my estimation, one of the more key elements that is an 800-pound gorilla, you can use the term very easily, modernize the education system. That's an 800-pound gorilla. I hope you're serious about that. We talked about that more. The other one, though, number 4, ensure excellent educators. If everything I've heard over the last 24 months is that educators are going to be in short supply, that you're going to be getting warm bodies. And quite frankly, though, on the other hand, as a state, K-12, you have little prerogative as far as the production of the quality teacher. And what's that mean? I remember in that session of school board one time that when we were looking and when we were recruiting teachers, we actually gave them a pretest because the quality was that big of a question mark. So that you can start winnowing out. So, I mean, in my estimation, that's a hard one. So I'll leave that aside, but those are two hugely important elements. But here is the tenet I think is the most important for us. So, rightfully so, No Child Left Behind had lots of words, and there was, you know, lots of critics of that, to include a lot of people in the room. But under No Child Left Behind, you still had the responsibility, right? And the main three things that are important, I think, for the way you think about this. Number one, we are still responsible. The commissioner is responsible to all of us, the parents. The biggest change is now you have the authority. You have the authority. You have to exercise that authority. And you say you're going to modernize the education system. You have the authority to do that. You got to get on with it. And the final one, which is the other 500-pound gorilla, is accountability. Now we're accountable to ourselves, right? We have the responsibility. We have the authority. And you look at the responsibility part of that and accountability. I'm sorry, we're accountable to ourselves. And I'll use a couple free terms, and I don't mean to say that we're dishonest, but we have to be candid, we have to be frank, and I'll use the term honest with ourselves about what we're really doing and not camouflaging what it is. Not camouflaging what it is. And so, I mean, now No Child Left Behind is gone. And we now have full prerogative with some minor little blips. And if we don't get it done, it's our fault. It's your fault. It's all of ours. Because, I mean, we sitting here, you know, have to help resource you and give you the support of that. But we've taken away most of the complaints under No Child Left Behind, as I recall. And now, it breaks late. And then you even went so far as something to modernize the education system. Quite frankly, that's a worthy thing to take on. That's multi-years. I beat the drum enough, but I think we just have to be honest with ourselves. There are little constraints about what we do or don't do. When we have to be honest about what happens in the big school over here and the little school over there. I'll give you a prime example. The Scholars Program. And I'll just ask you to start with that as far as being honest with ourselves. Who goes to school on the Scholars Program? Who graduates and who does it, what the percentile looks like, and it's not good. And we pay the what? also remind you that we had a ballot initiative that asked the people to look at a little bit of a break for students who are going to college as far as the funding and the percentage that it failed. There's some reason for that. There's some reason for that. The people ask it, don't approve it. Because, quite frankly, they don't think that we're quite as candid, and maybe camouflage a little bit more than what we're saying. But, and I'll just throw a number out there because it's one, there's lots of reasons to justify it. But when the former president of the university system was doing his analysis in 6 years, we talked about 4 years to graduate, maybe five, but 26% of the students that started 6 years later graduate from college. And that's a reason for that. It's 26%. That's a tough one. And there are lots of reasons for that. And the whole business remedial training, you covered that a little bit. That was one of the maximum efforts for remedial training, getting high school students ready to go to college. So this is super exciting. The new commissioner, you should be super excited. Blank this paper. You can go for it. Thank you.
So is that right?
You're saying people are quit. Page 10. So, just very briefly about the California Summer Confusion, aligned with college entrance requirements.
That the university requirements change to your knowledge statement?
Not to my knowledge, but I don't feel entirely qualified to speak to the entrance.
I don't think, so this is different than aligning to their standards, this statement here. It's aligning with their entrance requirements. So at the University of Alaska, Anchorage, for example, we're still working through whether we have one system or three systems, but if the University of Alaska, Anchorage says, to enroll in our program, you just need to pay your application fee and then graduate from high school, and maybe I think there's some approaches into the system you don't even have to graduate from high school, to all three lines, theoretically.
Chair Dunleavy, so again, the law itself is not at all specific about what college entrance requirements say.
Sure.
It would lead it to, in this case, the state of Alaska, to determine what that means. The analysis that was previously done was with regard to what I've already said, and that is if students meet our standards, will they be ready for college-bearing, credit-bearing classes as freshmen, not remedial, developmental, whatever the nuance is there. But that was the way we interpreted that requirement previously.
Okay.
I got a question as a follow-up. And I want to remind you that we're going to line those up a couple more questions and we'll get to one Molly Boehner. How many pagans are in ESSA?
Representative Keller,
roughly 400. Yep. Representative Keller, it's 300 and something without all the references, and if you include all the references, it's 1,000 pages.
Okay, it occurs to me that when you tell us that it's not specific, for example, on your consultation with the legislature, that really puts the burden on your back. And it looks like an impossible task. If they go through all this, and then they don't say anything specific about that. My guess is, in 1,000 pages, they're very specific about how you're supposed to interact with some of the stakeholder groups. And I'm just guessing. I'm just a pure guess. The mic's on and off, just a reminder. We're getting used to training legislators is tougher than training DED. That's a smart remark. I'm sorry. No, the point is that I would guess that there's been a lot of specificity as far as how you are to interact with certain groups in getting feedback. And I'm thinking, it sets you up because if you follow those standards, for example, to meet with the tribes and to find out what they want, then it seems like you might have to put those, to be fair, equal protection under the law and all that stuff, you have to apply that standard to everybody. And then, of course, at some point, the cost gets so high, you just kind of throw up your hands and say, So it's a leading question, but it just occurs to me that it's a tall order, picking and choosing and getting that. I would like to ask you a question related to that. You sent in public comment. What was it regarding the regulations on ESSA? I just wanted to ask you the question about, I can't hardly ask this without being pejorative, so I will, and then please be gracious. I don't have any negative feelings toward anybody in jail or anybody in the department or anything else. But my guess is that public feedback came from the Department of Education, which is a defined group with I'm going to call it a limited perspective, and did not get feedback specifically from Norm, specifically from School District ABC. If it did, I'll be delighted. I hope I'm walking into a trap here, because that the point of me trying to make is the burden's on your back to get this get the information that reflects the people of Alaska, the sovereigns, and the best access to that, I would like to point out, is the legislature, because of the fact that we are on a short leash by our constituents. And, you can post, when you meet with a stakeholder group, you can post all the information about what you're meeting with, So meeting with the future education committee on this stuff, we have a robust system, with the LIO getting the word out all over. And it would take you off the hook a little bit about making sure that you apply the same standard to stakeholder A group as you do to stakeholder B group, and et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if it's a question or not. Forgive me. Do you want to respond, please? Do.
Representative Keller, the requirements, let me rephrase that. The public comment process permits really any entity to submit public comment regarding those draft regulations. We felt a responsibility as the Department of Education, and in fact felt that we would be erring considerably to not provide response to those draft regs. In doing that, however, we did pull together an advisory committee for that purpose. And, I think it might have been 12 people in, make sure there were parent representation, principal representation, superintendent representation, and walked them through our take on the most off-putting elements of the draft regs and engaged them in conversation about that. How did they feel about that? Did they agree? Did they disagree? And then based our final public comment on their input. We also made sure that Teachers Association, School Boards Association, Superintendents Association were aware of the public comment that we had provided, so that they, on their own, if they wanted to, as organizations, could provide public comment or not. Our process did not, at that point, include legislative representation, and I think it's important to note your point there. But we did not develop that public comment behind closed doors in Juneau without consultation with some stakeholders.
Thank you, and I'm glad that I kind of walked into a trap. In other words, I commend you for having, for reaching out and getting the different groups, and I would encourage you to continue in that. Representative Rambo.
Thank you. So I'm going to stick back with the slide, page 10, primarily the Senate Office of Labor, 215, but you don't need to look at them because there's no good stuff. But basically, I want to know that you're completely empowered. The state board of education or DEED is completely empowered to change the standards. For example, if you chose to go to Massachusetts math standards, which I personally believe are far superior to what Alaska academic math standards are, you guys have complete freedom, is my understanding, to do that through DEED. You have the prescription through law and now through ESSA. So that's a question. Don't know if you want to answer that first.
Representative Blindel, we have complete discretion to do that through processes outlined in statute and approval processes with the State Board of Education.
Outstanding. Great news. Good to go ahead and move on. The assessments, as you know, there's been a challenge, the AMP assessments.
have been a huge challenge. And when they did the park assessments, you know, thousands of people were walking out of entire schools for not showing up for these assessments in this new assessment process. And I will be at the State Board of Education meeting, as you know, I pretty much show as much as I can tomorrow. But I want to know if the requirement is still there for these assessments to be fair, reliable, and valid assessments. And just to wrap up so you guys can answer this question, between what if there's an independent homeschooler that has not taken and has not done the Common Core standards, how is that going to impact them or international students that may come to our university system that may not have had Common Core? I know those are two completely different questions. And last but not least, the cost. Is there any additional cost for the state with ESSA?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, the requirements that state adopted assessments be valid, reliable, and of high technical quality is still there. I'm not sure that I entirely understand your question with regard to students who come to us internationally or those who have been independently homeschooled. The system, both in our state law and the federal requirements, are that states adopt standards that outline what students are supposed to know and be able to do at each grade level, that they assess students' attainment of those standards. The federal requirements, as we said, are grades 3 through 8 and 1 through high school, and that those assessments are aligned to the standards. That's the basic setup with regard to our public school system. So, I'm sorry, I'm feeling like I didn't answer your question, but I'm not sure I entirely understood.
Okay, so I'll just give you a rhetorical, let's just say a mom had 6 kids, she decided to homeschool all of her children, and they did not do anything with Alaska academic standards, but yet they decide they want to go to University of Alaska. Is this going to impact them in any way? We don't want to strip any freedom from them. And also there's college requirements here with the college interest requirements. We just want to make sure, like Senator Dunlap was saying, there's a lot of military people that may come up and want to go to our university system. We may have international students. Is that going to impact college because they didn't go through this, you know, some of these other assessments? Is this going to impact them in any way?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I think the answer to your question is no. Those requirements are in place for students who attend public schools in the state of Alaska exclusively, not independent homeschooling through, you know, other means other than public homeschooling programs, not who come to us having been schooled someplace else and want to go to our university. Those requirements are not in place for those students.
Okay, thank you. And then the last question was cost. Is ESSA, you know, in a fiscal crisis, is there a penny more? Because we're, as you know, we're with a huge budget crisis on our hands. We want to know if ESSA, if, you know, if legislators have to deal with this budget, any additional?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I think the easiest way to answer your question would be to contrast the requirements of ESSA with the requirements for our NCLB accountability waiver. Flexibility waiver, excuse me. So that some of the provisions for the NCLB flexibility waiver that caused some consternation in terms of costs, ultimately, are completely absent from ESSA. And in fact, some of those that were even just in the original NCLB are completely absent from ESSA. And I'll give you two examples. NCLB required teachers to obtain highly qualified status. That required a great deal of record keeping at the local level, reporting to be plans to get teachers to highly qualified status if they weren't. All of that is stripped in ESSA. The NCLB flexibility waiver required evaluation systems that used student performance data as part of evaluations. That is entirely absent from ESSA. So there are no, in my opinion, my opinion, there are not requirements in ESSA that are going to result in a lot of quote-unquote unfunded mandates, new requirements, complicated systems, as was the case with NCLB and the NCLB flexibility waiver.
I represent Seton, and I think Senator Gumby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 25, 6, and 7, looking at school support and improvement. I just returned not long ago from a national conference of state legislators, health committee chairs, and there's been a movement away from evidence-based to research-based, because evidence-based was defined as significant result in randomized control experiments or design projects, so which was very, very restrictive. And I'm wondering, is this the same movement? Because here we would be going to something that would have, if that was the same definition that we're using for evidence-based here, that would be kind of contrary to the flexibility. So if you could.
Through the chair, Representative Seton, just trying to find something in particular and make sure that I can on the fly here. The intent here is to move from a kind of heavy-hitting technical requirement of research-based to a softer evidence-based requirement. Meaning that under No Child Left Behind, unless intervention methods or support strategies had a strong research base, they were not going to meet with approval from the U.S. Department of Education. The intent here is that there be an indication that improvement strategies or supports are likely to improve student achievement, and there needs to be some evidence of that. But it does not need to reach the, you know, threshold of what you talked about in terms of random controlled trials and all of those things. But again, the sentiment here is because that requirement, it is perceived that that requirement impedes innovation that might likely result in significant improvement.
And I guess I just wanted to make sure, because the federal terminology is exactly the opposite in the health department. So would you check on that, and if that does not turn out to be the case, and if we need something in our state requirements or clarification from the legislature, please bring that to us. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you for raising the question. I had the same question, and it sounds to me like it's just definition of research and evidence-based. And then the follow-up question on that would be, and the evidence then is that supplied by the state. In other words, our coaching program, our teacher coaching program is an improvement element. If there's no studies out there that put it in the research category, can we provide anecdotal and specific, you know, what we think works, and that therefore it would be more likely to be approved?
Representative Keller, so and this is all very recent information. So the final regulations that came out last week do touch on this business of evidence-based, research-based. And we've done a cursory review of those, but we need to obviously get clearer about that. If what the regs say is that the state can determine and approve a list of intervention strategies. It can do that, or doesn't have to do that if they don't want to. If a state determines intervention strategies, the law says that they must be supported, quote, to the extent practicable by the strongest levels of evidence. And so, again, even the regulations are still vague, to the extent practicable. You know, what does that mean? But again, the sentiment here, I think, is really clear. It's two things. When we engage in supports and interventions to schools, there should be some evidence that they are likely to be effective. However, that evidence should not be held to a threshold that restricts innovations that might be effective in a way that previous intervention strategies haven't. Where the line is there, though, is vague for me personally at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. And I just would point out that in most research, when they say the strongest level of evidence, they were talking about randomized controlled trials. And so I hope that we get some clarification. I'm not asking for it today, but I get worried when I just came from a healthcare conference and it was the exact opposite, that they were going to research-based instead of evidence-based, because evidence-based required these, you know, it delayed innovation because it required randomized controlled trials before they could implement health policies in Maine. And so I appreciate that, and I appreciate follow-up coming up.
Good question. I think it emphasizes my point to the Department of Education and maybe us too, you know, given an impossible task here by ESSA. So we were better off, getting to be proactive and with our, I'm glad you started where you did, our missions, goals, objectives, and, and use that as a driver rather than the letters of the obscure law. That's great. I forgot, I'm sorry. Just a follow-up to you.
Yeah, there's a few piles going up. Not that you need to. Just a follow-up. The way things are lined out now, you can basically fall out of a tree and still attend college through certain ways to get into college. You don't need a high school diploma in many cases. You don't. If you graduate from any of our private schools in the state of Alaska, you have no high school diploma, state diploma. You can be a homeschooler. You can be a foreign student. You can be somebody from another state. So, I mean, there's all kinds of holes in that whole thing. And the idea that, and this is, I guess, the part that really, it's an eye roller for me, is setting us all up for our public school systems in the state of Alaska to align with the university, that's fine. But there's so many other holes to get into the university and so many other holes in this whole process. It's something for another discussion. There was talk about changing or allowing a distance graduation period, 4 years, the 4 years to go to 5 years for certain subgroups. So if you want to have a situation, so the last month of a situation where students are getting their high school diploma for 5 or 6 years, but at the same time they're getting college courses simultaneously, like a middle college concept, is that going to be problematic before there was an icon that would go into the system that would show that a student did not complete in 4 years because, yes, NCLB was still hanging up on social promotion type of process? What you're saying now that if we want to say, yeah, we're a subgroup, so they go to college at the same time they're getting their high school diploma and they're not going to graduate for 6 or 7 years, is that something that can work under ESSA?
Senator Dunleavy, so the language in ESSA is not specific to subgroups.
You should know that.
The language in ESSA is specific to schools that serve special populations. The expectation in general is that there is accountability for, according to the 4-year cohort graduation rate. What the law permits is a state to instead utilize what they call an extended year graduation rate for schools that serve special populations with justification for doing that. So just want to give you an example. We, through our NCLB flexibility waiver structures, we submitted an alternate metric to the U.S. Department of Education for all our alternative schools. Part of that alternate metric was the use of a 5-year graduation rate because of the nature of the students they serve and their credit deficient status and their really impressive evidence of the growth those students attain when they come to those schools, and we felt that the standardized metric was inappropriately punitive for those schools. And so we identified, I forget how many, but we identified the group of alternative schools who serve, quote-unquote, that special special population students. We revised the metric, and the U.S. Department of Education approved that. We were actually kind of surprised that they did. SNL entirely permits that. But it's not with subgroups. It's with entire schools that serve what the law calls special populations, and we have to justify why we want to do that.
So can we have special populations that aren't students that are attending a hybrid program where they're getting college courses and high school diploma at the same time that may not do it in 4 years?
Senator Dunleavy, my take on that is that scenario would meet the language in the law that speaks to the application of an extended year graduation rate to a school that serves a special population.
So it could happen.
My take on it is that it could.
Okay, thank you. And then two real quick questions. If we're looking at, if we're trying to prepare students for whatever, a career in going to college, for example, or alternative route to blue-collar work, however you want to define it, why not adopt an assessment that is an entrance exam for those professions or that system as opposed to an exit exam? In other words, there are currently assessments on the market right now. The PSAT is used nationally, and it's inexpensive, and it's supposedly research-wise, it's an indicator of success at college. Why not adopt that for students that may want to look at a different track, for example, blue-collar work, Rookies or something similar? Why not adopt that? Why go out and contract, and I'm not saying you are, I don't know what you're doing, but why go out and contract and invent something brand new just for Alaska if, again, when students are coming up from the lower 48 or whatever, the university either uses PSAT or AccuPlacer? Why not adopt those assessments? They're already out there, they're inexpensive, they're already being used by these organizations. What is the department thinking of doing in terms of this assessment approach?
Senator, we'll cover quite a bit of that in the House Bill 156 section.
And then one last question. We'll wait till then.
Okay.
One last question, and maybe you'll cover HB 156 too, but again, another year of this. If I don't want my child taking your assessment, is the school going to be penalized? Is there going to be a belief that if they had a 95% or less that they will lose funding? Are we going to cover that in HB 156 as well? Okay.
Okay, any other questions on the presentation? I will turn back to the gentleman, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that the department accepted the flexibility with the four-year graduation rate for schools that serve special populations, but does that mean that regular comprehensive high schools can't use the same way of tracking their graduates?
For the purposes of state adopted accountability system under ESSA,
what the law says is that the four-year graduation rate must be used unless a school is serving a special population and there is some justification for it. We crunch, so to speak, four-year and five-year graduation rates. But if we want to use something other than the four-year graduation rate, where the clock starts ticking, so to speak, when a student starts their freshman year and do they graduate 4 years later, we have to justify that decision to the U.S. Department of Education.
Mm-hmm. That seems a shame because I do believe that the need to allow for five-year graduation exists in outside of alternative programs. So I suppose a comprehensive high school could say that we have a subgroup that has contracts, for example, that allows them to finish their degree in a longer than 4 year period.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, I wanted to make clear that, you know, we're talking about potentially two different things. One is, you know, the degree to which we as a state message the support for students who graduate, period, whether it takes 4 years or 5 years, and how we bring value to that and how we talk about that in the state of Alaska. The other is an accountability system for the purpose of meeting federal requirements. And right now, the law permits it, but says that it needs to be goals of those special populations and with specification. There is, interestingly, throughout the law itself, frequent reference to four-year and extended year graduation rate, which is why, you know, our initial read on the law felt that that was a really good move in the right direction. When the draft regulations then specified only the use of four-year graduation rate, we felt that was inconsistent with the frequent mention of extended year graduation rate in the law itself. And they, the U.S. Department of Ed, then revised their initial regs and did open the door, again, in a way that their initial regs did not, but with those two caveats, schools of those special populations and with justification. And that's where it sits right now with the quote-unquote final regs. And, you know, I don't, those have come out so recently that I don't yet have a feel for the degree to which that is meeting with, you know, approval across the country. It's just too new and fresh. We haven't really fully thought through that yet either, so it's just that.
I would be interested in exploring the flexibility beyond simply the alternative schools.
Okay. So the committee was scheduled for four, right? And light of that, I really want to press on. If you are needing a break, please just independently go. It's straight up. The restrooms are down the hall. We're going to proceed right on. If you need a break, okay. Well, okay, let's take 5 minutes. But we'll come back quarter two and start promptly. Okay, we're back on the record, and I want to say that we have 15 minutes left, and that's what we want to make. We need a good use of the time. If we run a little over, I apologize, but this is important stuff. There's a number of people listening carefully to where we're at, what's going to happen on the test, what's required of them. And so going over HB 156, so hopefully we'll answer those questions. Try to be real succinct in your questions when they're done with the presentation. If you would, please proceed.
Again, for the record, Susan McCauley, Department of Education, going in the interest of our 15 minutes, I'm going to go through this really quickly. We focused on House Bill 156 on the sections of the bill that had obvious implications for action by the Department of Education. The first is Section 5 that talks about a comparison that requires a comparison of the state public school system to public schools in other states. We have not yet determined how to do that. I remember talking with Representative Keller during the last session and clarifying some expectations there. We could use NAEP scores to meet those requirements, particularly because NAEP includes data from all 50 states, or we could do some comparisons with other states through our new assessment, but we've not yet made that determination. House Bill 156 requires a program of special recognition for public schools and some specific components there. And obviously, we will move to include that requirement in our as-a-state plan if the ESSA doesn't require that, but our state law does. And so when we design our new accountability system, we will make sure that we have a program of special recognition because that's what our law requires. House Bill 156, in terms of selecting an assessment, it says that standards-based assessments must be selected with input of teachers and school administrators and minimize disruption to classroom instruction. The process for selecting the new assessment included a great deal of stakeholder input, and we really appreciated the flexibility given to us through House Bill 156 in alleviating us from the state procurement processes. And that permitted us a lot more flexibility when including stakeholders than has previously been the case through the procurement process. I won't say any more about that. So we did a couple of things with regard to that. We put together a stakeholder group of 21 representatives who reviewed the submitted proposals and provided us feedback about the pluses and minuses of each one of those. We then followed up with that committee several more times as we went through the process of determining what assessment we would have. We then very recently held webinar calls with stakeholder groups prior to publicly announcing the vendor selection, went through our processes, reviewed with them what we had heard from stakeholders in terms of the pros and cons of the assessment, and did one final check with superintendents, with teachers, to make sure that we weren't missing anything prior to determining that. It was made very clear by the commissioner to department staff that this process for selecting an assessment would look different than previous processes. That, and it, in fact, the commissioner delayed the process in order to ensure that that happened, as is consistent, in our opinion, with the requirements of House Bill 156. The department staff intended to, I think, have a more speedy decision, and the commissioner in July quickly ruled out at that. So we now need to consider, though we did it obviously during the selection process, and probably we're going to need to go into this in greater detail at another time, but the second requirement there is minimize disruption to classroom instruction through the selection process. There was a lot of consideration of length of the assessment, how much instructional time does that take. So we now need to, as we're working with the vendor, we now need to be very clear about what that looks like. But we do notice that districts will be able to choose computer-based or paper-based. They will make that decision. They also will be able to set specific school schedules within a testing window. Neither of those things is going to be prescribed by the Department of Education. Another section of House Bill 156, Section 9, says that we may consult with the University of Alaska to develop secondary education requirements. There has been increased partnership with the university. University President and Commissioner Johnson, as directed by the State Board of Education and the Board of Regents, and in light of language in House Bill 156. The Commissioner and President Johnson are working closely together on that. There is a subgroup committee of both Board of Regents and State Board members that are directing that work. And of primary consideration initially, as an agreed upon way in or topic, is how to reduce the number of UA students who are currently needing developmental coursework. Section 9 says that the department may consult with business and labor unions to develop a program to prepare students for apprenticeships or internships. There has been conversation between the president of the Statewide Chamber of Commerce and Commissioner Johnson and our State Board of Education related to this language. There's a beginning conversation that they have focused on how to engage the business community in Alaska in supporting apprenticeships or internships for students, how to open up the walls of the school or classroom or district, so to speak, and get kids engaged in learning experiences outside of the traditional public school setting for credit toward graduation and ideally post-secondary credit as well. Those are beginning conversations. Commissioner Johnson spent time with the Statewide Chamber of Commerce talking with folks about that just a month or so ago. Section 10 says that the department may not require a school or district to administer a standards-based assessment after July 1st and before July 1 of 2018, that we need to create a plan for working with school districts to develop or select statewide assessments that are approved, and the plan must provide for the first administration, not later than school year 2020. The law, that section of the law also says that we shall require a school district or school to administer a statewide standards-based assessment if we receive notification from the U.S. Department of Education that it intends to withhold funds. we will move forward to offer a standards-based assessment to districts. Consistent with the language in House Bill 156, it is a district's decision whether or not to administer those assessments. Districts do annually sign assurances when they apply for federal funds, and part of those assurances is that they will administer standards-based assessments. They have the decision to whether sign those assurances or not. At this point, all districts have signed those assurances. But again, House Bill 156 is clear about two things, that the Department of Education cannot require, that it is a district's decision, and if a district chooses to administer an assessment, parents still have the right to choose whether or not their students take them. And House Bill 156 is very clear about both of those issues. The U.S. Department of Education has confirmed in a letter to us that we have to administer an assessment. This requirement was included in a letter we received from them when they told us that they were going to waive our assessment requirements for last year in light of our canceling the assessment and inquiring with them about whether or not there would be consequences for that. So they clarified that they did, in fact, waive those requirements and further clarified the expectation that the Department of Education administer an assessment for this school year. And we have moved forward to meet those requirements and offer that assessment to districts.
I'm sorry, the section 101 in the sectional is in there. I take full responsibility for that. There is no written permission needed from parents.
Yeah,
we want a clear error.
Come
detail.
Back to me on this assessment issue, if you will.
Thank you.
So just want to be crystal clear for parents and school districts and teachers and principals and anyone listening. As part of the agreement with the state and districts, with the feds, the state and districts agreed to administer an assessment.
Senator Dunleavy, the Department of Education agreed to offer a standards-based assessment for districts.
Okay. We don't have to administer an assessment. Bear with me. I'm using my words, choosing my words very carefully. As part of accepting the grant, we have to administer an assessment. Yes.
Yeah.
But parents are under no obligation to force their children to take the assessment.
That's correct.
Yes. Will school districts be threatened in any form or fashion, coerced in any form or fashion, or made to feel bad, for lack of a better way to say it, if there are a number of parents in a specific school that choose not to send their children to school that day to take the assessment, yes or no?
No.
Has the federal government in any form or fashion threaten the state and or school districts that if parents decided not to send their children to school that day to take the assessment, that they will be penalized funding-wise or some other method or format we're not familiar with?
Senator Dunleavy, what ESSA says, the answer to your question depends on your definition of threat. What ESSA says is that there is an expectation that schools, districts, and states reach a 95% participation rate, and that we somehow factor that in to our state accountability system. The law is vague in terms of, so what happens if we don't? The regulations that came out last week says that states may use one of four methods to respond to test participation rates that fall below the 95% threshold. They may lower the summative performance rating of a school that doesn't meet it. They may identify for targeted support and improvement. Again, though they don't define targeted support and improvement, a school that doesn't need it. They may lower the performance level on the academic indicator, those five indicators. They may lower that a level. Or this, a state-determined action that is sufficiently rigorous and described in the state plan.
Gotcha. So nowhere does it say they'll take their funding away. Nowhere is it explicit. I guess what I'm driving at here is, are we going to get phone calls this year from parents saying, our school said it sent us a letter, or the school said that the department said we need to send our children to school to take an assessment that we don't want them taking? That, in many respects, it's the heart of HB 156, at least the section for myself. So the question is anyone anywhere going to tell a school, particular school, that they will lose funding if parents decide? School administers the assessment, everyone lays a book on everyone's desk and a sharpened pencil and so forth, and five students come to a class of 30 to take the assessment. Thank you.
My guess is that the Department of Law may be further involved in this.
I hope not.
Representative Caldwell's question and Representative.
Thank you. I guess my concern is, obviously we've learned from the previous assessment, one of the problems that I heard was that, well, my kid doesn't have IT classes for a whole month because we had to shut down all the computers. Some schools have enough of these carts that they can run around and administer the test. It was disruptive in the class schedule. The test was administered over several weeks, so not a lot of other learning was happening. And so that's one issue I'd like you to address, how we're going to handle that. And the other one is, I looked at the results of my kid's test, and it was a speedometer score. And the concern that I think the department heard and we heard as well was that we didn't have, quote-unquote, any usable specific data to improve student learning. Are they deficient in fractions, grammar? We had the score that said you're proficient or not, or how you did, but we were looking for something like more definitive on what areas needed improvement for each student and how are we progressing with the stakeholders to get a test and then administer it first time and not having time to pilot it or anything. So how are we going to get to what the districts and the students will be able to use for improved learning rather than just a good, bad score?
So a couple of things, briefly through the chair, Representative Colbert. Before the commissioner would move forward to select a new assessment, he clarified the purpose of assessment as defined in statute and regulations. The purpose of assessment as defined in our state law is to inform policy level decision making for the improvement of student learning in the state of Alaska. I think that one of the problems we had with our last assessment is that we attempted to make it be everything to everyone and inadvertently and unintentionally then put it in competition with assessments at the local level that are much better able to provide the kind of information that we described than a state level summative assessment. We then moved to develop reports to provide useful data when in fact the purpose outlined in our state law for assessment is for policy level decision making and general system level accountability of public schools in Alaska. Our districts in Alaska, the vast majority of them have assessments that are considered highly valuable and inform classroom instruction in place. They reminded that those assessments were in competition with a state level summative assessment. So the commissioner has specifically talked about this and consistently talked about this as an additional thin layer. We want to be sure that we have an assessment in place that meets the requirements of our state law for informing policy-level decision-making that has an accountability component for the public schools in Alaska that is not overly burdensome and not attempting to duplicate or complicate what our districts are already doing. So the report, we believe, will be more valuable in part because they will not attempt to duplicate what is already done at the local level. This assessment, as defined currently in our state law, is not meant to inform day-to-day decision-making by educators. And I think that we have learned some valuable lessons in terms of what the state summative assessment should do and should not attempt to do. And I think being thoughtful about that, being clear about what our state law says, rather than just rushing in to obtain another assessment was very wise, and the flexibility given in House Bill 156 for not using the procurement process was very helpful. As a state in education, we must increase trust. As you know, with the AMP assessments, and there's been lots of issues, and there's major issues with some of the standards, the credibility. A lot of us have been given a mandate for fiscal responsibility in education and healthcare and a few other areas of the government. Sounds like there's no increased cost from everything that I hear you saying with ESSA. A lot of the legislators, a lot of the people want state sovereignty over education and don't believe that the federal government should be mandating. It's kind of a history of failure over since 1965, like billions and billions and billions of dollars. So I guess a lot of times legislators are given a mandate, but sometimes bureaucrats are given a different mandate because their loyalty sometimes is to the federal government because their positions may be funded by the federal government. So I guess basically I just really do think that we need to answer to the people, because in essence all the money from government ends up coming out of, you know, the private sector's pocket. So I think that's one issue. But I really do want to comment in regard to Senator Dunleavy's. I don't believe it's a day that they take assessments. I think there's a window, and I just want to make sure that, I mean, there's not confusion here, and I think his point is extremely important and the purpose of House Bill 156 and of course Chair Keller as well. But what I want to ask is, the specifically going to have an opt-out procedure required by the district in order to honor the intent of this law? And number two, can we get a letter, a copy of the correspondence between, you know, Commissioner Johnson and the federal government, so we can also read those letters and interpret them?
Senator Representative Reinberg, it is not going to have a standardized opt-out procedure for districts. And in my opinion, doing that would be inconsistent with the requirements of House Bill 156. House Bill 156 requires a local school board to establish policy and procedures to permit that opting out by parents. Districts will choose different ways of doing that. Some may have already informed that parents of that through registration procedures. Some will add that information to established processes when they send out information about the assessment at the start of next semester. Some will use their websites to do that. Some may have informed parents of that or will during parent conferences. And that those procedures and policies just look so different across the state in light of the diversity of our schools that I think it's wise in terms of the language in House Bill 156, that those are local policy considerations and procedures that they are expected to have in place.
A follow-up on that, that's a very good question. I'm glad you asked it. You're absolutely right. The language of the bill is directed at the local school districts, not the Department of Education. I think that the Department of Education probably has the prerogative of offering a standardization, but like you say, that probably may not be wise. So, no, I'm not going to call them up here, but Norm Wooten is here from the Alaska Association of School Boards, and Lisa's here, right? Anyway, if we could get some, I just would like to respectfully request that you give us some kind of an overview, in the upcoming session in the Education Committee, as far as what the different districts have done or have chosen to do on that, and what you've done to notify the local school boards of their responsibility on this last. There is, I want to add to this, that there is no consequence built into the law. The school districts will not get fined if they don't comply. At least that's not specifically all in the law. So it's a good faith. I want to point out that the whole point is a good faith effort here to get the parents and the
department and the state and legislature to all be kind of working to the same end without confusion. So that's just a request to put on the record. Reverend Seaton.
Thank you. Just wanted to get a little more clarification on the accountability nature. So if the 95% isn't met, then that means a school that would have been a three-star school would be reported possibly as a two-star school. What were the other measures that would be the accountability section?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, that the school be identified for targeted support and improvement, that they receive the lowest performance level on the academic indicator portion of the metric, or a state-determined action that is sufficiently rigorous and described in the state's plan.
Can I follow up? Is there something contemplated to be described in the state plan for that?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we have not determined which of those four options we will land on in terms of compliance with efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gardner, personally, Representative Gelman, if I missed you earlier to get you on the list, I apologize. I think I saw something on the recording.
Thank you. My question pertains to page 33 and comparison with other states. And the last sentence on that page says comparisons with some other states are possible with our new assessment. But if our new assessment is unique to us, we've contracted to have something done specifically for us, how would it be possible for us to compare with other states in terms of student performance on the assessments?
With the chair, Senator Gardner, the new assessment is not used exclusively by Alaska, though you know, we're in the early stages of determining exactly what that assessment looks like, in part in keeping with the minimized disruption to classroom instruction requirement in House Bill 156. It is possible that there could be some comparison or calibration metrics done in order to meet this requirement in our state law through the new assessment. We've got to figure that out. And it's at least a question in our mind right now whether whatever we can do with our new assessment will be superior to what we can do with NAEP, given that NAEP is taken by all 56. We've just got to figure it out. And we're new enough in terms of selection of the assessment and working with the vendor, but we just don't entirely know yet how we're going to move this.
I have to jump in and just do some clarification. First of all, this is in HB 156, that's a compliance section. In other words, it was a requirement there all along. All it did was say, okay, you know, let's get it done. And I think leading the school board and the MB to come up with the standards of comparison is completely legitimate. And from my own personal perspective, grading straight pure by NAEP would be a great reminder just for everybody to see how we're doing with other states. But that's not up to me. That's up to the state board, and it's up to the department to come up with the mechanism for making that determination. But it is not a new requirement. That requirement is going to make it and done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I understand that point, and I tend to agree with you about using the NAEP samples since they're already used all over the country. I guess I'd just say for that last sentence, it might be more accurate to say comparisons with some other states might be possible with our new assessment, because we really don't know that.
Good point.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if I'm confused, but this document, the sectional analysis on HB 156 says on page 3, on section 10, adds a new section prohibiting the department from requiring a school district to administer a statewide standards-based assessment after July 1st, 2017 and before July 1st, 2019, while slide 38 says after July 1st, 2016 and before July 1st, 2018. I'm confused because that is not consistent. I'm also very concerned that we're going to be going for a very long time between state standards-based assessments. And if we're going to have to make policy decisions, we're not going to have a lot of data
I will let the department try to explain the date. If it's an error, I'm not sure. But I just want to point out that, again, all the school districts have agreed to take the statewide assessments, and this is in process. So there is no real vacuum there. It's just a, just put the burden on the department to maybe motivate or accomplish the federal requirements without the power of state law backing them up. We could not require the districts to comply. But do you have a further comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative, our quick look at it indicates this section might be incorrect. And I think your clarification answers the question. The law does not prohibit the department from administering, and we are moving forward to administer. It prohibits the department from requiring.
Okay. Not an excuse. I want to explain the sectional. You know, when you have to come up with a sectional for a bill that isn't in the process, I could either go back and take the most recent one off the floor or write her own, and I asked her to turn me to write her own quick and get it out there. I apologize for the mistakes. I made them. Okay. Senator Dunleavy.
Just for me, I just want to thank you folks for being prepared for this meeting, for everyone else who's come to it, because education is probably, for many of us, if not the most important endeavor the state does, one of the most important. But long story short, part of the push behind us, and I want to thank Representative Keller, was to remind the federal government, and to be honest with you, to remind the Department of Education, that it's the people of Alaska we serve, not the other way around. That it's not the federal government we serve. We are not subjects of the federal government. It's a Republican form of government we have. The people elect us to come here and make laws and work with you guys. But something happened in 65. It was a historical fact. There were things going on in parts of the country in terms of civil rights movement. However, I think that 65 to now, many decades ago, things have changed a little bit, and the point I'm trying to make is, when in doubt, and I'm looking at the commissioner, err on the side of the people of Alaska. When in doubt, work with their representatives on the educational matters. When in doubt, if the question is a choice between serving the needs of the federal, in this case, it's really USDOE bureaucracy, because the law has already been made, when the people of Alaska and the representatives work with us, side with us, then you're part of the state. That's all I'm asking.
Perfect last word at 4:15. Again, thank you, Ditto.
Your host is exiting the conference.